Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall, and in this episode, we'll be taking a look at the gonfatheas of South America with Dr. Damila Motte at the Federal University of the State of Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. This episode wouldn't have been possible without my crash course in proboscideans provided by Stephen Zhang, so a big thanks to him. As a group of animals, they're about as far removed from my usual arthropods as possible, so it was a steep learning curve for me, and I even found out something new about elephants, but something that I've since come to realise that everyone else already knew. But before we get into the interview, we've got our usual PaleoCast news to get through. A few weeks ago, we made a successful live stream of the Progressive Paleontology Conference in Leicester, so thanks to everyone that tuned in. If you missed it, don't worry, we recorded the whole thing and we'll be releasing videos very soon. And you'll want to see those because of my award-winning talk. It sounds prestigious, but I only won because I gave a presentation without using PowerPoint to create my slides. It was all done by hand the night before with a marker pen on paper, and so it was quite the spectacle. Another conference we'll be recording from soon is ISECT, the International Symposium on the Ediacaran and Cambrian Transition, held in St. John's, Newfoundland, Canada. So you'll all be able to get fully up to date on the latest research into the Rangiomorphs and the Cambrian Explosion. For this conference and for all future PaleoCast video work, we've been granted the use of a semi-professional camera by the Paleobiology Department of the University of Bristol, so a huge thanks to all of our friends there. Expect to see a serious step up in video quality from us from this point forward. Finally, we recently had an open day for the Virtual Natural History Museum's backers, and we were really excited by the positive feedback we received, and even managed to meet a load of people in the museum itself. One of our goals with the VNHM is to continually develop the museum, and the first phase of this would be to add a completely original musical soundtrack that will give the museum its soul. And so this is what's been playing in the introduction so far, and is what will replace our usual intro music for this episode. The composer is the supremely talented James Waymont, and so please check out his other tracks on jameswaymont.com, and let us know what you think of this piece. As always, we sign off with a request to like and share this interview on social media and to let us know what you want to hear from us in future. PaleoCast is now available via iTunes, Google Play and Stitcher, so ratings on any of these sites would be most welcomed. We hope you enjoy this episode on the gonfatheas of South America. So, Damila, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Can you give us an introduction to yourself, please?
Yeah, my name is Damila Motte. I'm a Brazilian paleontologist, and I study fossil proboscideans. What more can I say?
Hey, that's all you need to say, to be honest.
Great.
What more do we all need to know? But what was your route into paleontology, and especially proboscideans?
Yeah, I didn't start with the proboscideans. Actually, I start in my undergraduation with studying the taphonomy of mollusks. But it was not what I was into. And then I looked for a lab where I could study mammals. Extant or fossil, doesn't matter. But at that time, the mammalogy lab at the same university that I am now, the Federal University of the State of Rio de Janeiro, offered me a project to study the fossil proboscideans that were described by Simpson and Carlos de Paula Couto at the 50s. So I was very interested in this project, and then I started to study this population.
Sure. And is it nice now to be having a postdoc back at the same place again?
Sure, totally. Actually, I used to say that I am the specimen number one of this Mammalus lab.
All right.
Because I'm working with this team, I think, for 10 years this year.
Wow.
And yeah, and actually, I did my my graduation at the National Museum, also in Brazil, but I never left the mammalogy lab, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then now I have postdoc position there.
And would you like to stay and be a member of academic staff?
Totally. It's great to work there.
Brilliant. So we've said that you've been working on proboscideans. Now, Before I wrote the script for this interview, I didn't really know what a proboscidean was. Can you explain it to us all, what a proboscidean actually is?
Well, a proboscidean is the group of mammals that include mammoths, elephants, mastodons, and a lot of other extinct groups. But actually, we have a lot of specific features that say that an animal is a proboscidean, like the structure of the enamel, the position of the limbs. But the most specific one is the presence of a trunk, but not any trunk, like the tapirs, they also have a trunk, but a trunk that is composed by the upper lip and the nose structures.
But they also have upper lips, don't they?
No. Actually, well, they have, but the trunk is a fusion of the upper lip and nose.
So when we look at an elephant nowadays, is it the lower half of the trunk? Is that the lip?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to have to take a moment to actually think about that. It never occurred to me that that was what was happening. I just had assumed that it was its long nose. Wow.
No, not only the nose. Yeah, if you see the calves, the baby elephants, they usually, they don't know how to use exactly the trunk. When they start learning, is so beautiful to see, because they explore everything around and they don't know how to control the muscles. It's very interesting because you can see perfectly when they put the trunk up and you see the mouth open. It's very cute, actually.
Okay, well, I'm learning something. I don't know if that was common knowledge,
Great.
But it's definitely something I've learned today.
Great.
So the characteristics that define what a proboscidean are the enamel, mm-hmm. the position of the limbs, and the trunk. But what's the difference between the groups they're in? So we've got mastodons, we've got the mammoths, and we've got the elephants. What's the difference between them?
Well, there's a lot of differences. Basically, the mammoths and elephants, including the African elephant or the Asian elephant, they belong to the same family. That's the family Elephantid. So they are more closely related than the gomphotheres and mastodons. The true mastodons, they belong to the family Mammutid. And there's a common, not mistake, but there's a common confusion on the name of this family, because the mammutids are the true mastodons, not the mammoths. And yeah, I took a long time. Sorry, what?
That sounds horrendously confusing.
Yeah, it took a long time to understand this when I was at the undergraduate, but okay. The mastodons, the true mastodons, are like the Mammut Americanum, and the, oh, described last year, described the Chinese mastodon called Sino-Mammut. So they're not mammoths. They are true mastodons. And they have a lot of specific features like molars and other features on skull and everything that make them mastodons. Gomphotheres. How can I say? Gomphotheres are everything left. Like the most perfect book on proboscideans by Shoshani and Tassi from 96, they define gomphotheres as the proboscideans that are not easily classified as an elephantid or as a mammothid, and they have a bunodont teeth. And they used to say that they are the trash basket of the group.
So everything that doesn't fit within the others is a gomphothere.
Exactly.
Okay. So I just want to get to why we have mammoths and also mammotids. Was it the case that mammoths were named first and it contained mammoths and mastodons, true mastodons, and then they realized they were different? Is that what happened?
The genus mastodon, it was used like 100 years ago for a lot of proboscideans with teeth that has like conical cusps. So they seem very similar or from the same genus, but the taxonomy evolves, and then several authors saw that they were not the same group or even the same family. And then the name mastodon actually became popular. But the taxonomy didn't follow the popular names.
Sure, okay, so it's a bit of a relic name.
Yeah.
So we'll just be concentrating on the gomphotheres today. Can you tell us when these were alive?
The oldest one, I believe it's Gomphotherium, from early Miocene or the end of Oligocene from Africa. And they were alive until early Holocene, but not Gomphotherium. Gomphotherium went extinct on the Miocene-Pliocene transition. And then other groups of gomphotheres reached the late Quaternary or the beginning of the Holocene.
And how does this relate to the other proboscidean groups? So I guess we've got elephantids still around today, the elephants. But in relation to mastodons and mammoths, were they younger or older?
They are older than the elephantid groups, such as the mammoths and the elephants, but they are the same age or a little bit younger than the mastodons, the mammothids.
Okay, so the mastodons, the true mastodons, are the oldest ones.
Not the oldest ones. Actually, we have another group, the Deinotherid family, that they are older than all these lineages that started being recorded from Miocene on. The Deinotheres are older than them.
So is there an overlap of gomphotheres with early hominids?
Completely, yeah. We have in South America, at least, a lot of paleoarchaeological sites with human remains and proboscidean remains. Mostly, if not all records, are Notomastodon platensis, the proboscidean that's endemic to South America. And we have a lot of sites with human and Notomastodon remains. We have also in Mexico some remains of gomphotheres and human sites.
Yeah, so I think we'll explore a bit of that relationship later. But let's get into the paleoecology of the gomphotheres. Okay. What lines of evidence can we draw upon?
We know a lot of about the paleo diet of these proboscideans, but we need to study a lot more. The paleoecology is very interesting because we found that for some taxa, they were mixed feeders. They could eat almost everything available on the environment. Like Cuveronius, Notomastodon in South America. But to other places like North America, we have other hypotheses. Like some had grazer habits, such as Stegomastodon. So it, this species would prefer grasses. And Gomphotherium, for example, it's believed that it was more browser. So it would eat more leaves or parts of trees, fruits.
So how can you tell what kinds of things they were eating? Do we have like microware on the teeth?
Yeah, there's a lot of techniques. I think one of the most studied is the isotopes. They found a lot of great information, including information on the environment, on water, on everything. But at the mammalogy lab, we study two techniques. We use two techniques that complement each other. The microware on the enamel. We analyze the scars that the food items make on the enamel on the of the molars, and according with the number of the scars, like pits or scratches, we can identify or at least infer the most probably feeding habit of this individual and a population and the species as a whole. The other way we get paleoecological information is from the study on dental plaque. Mastodons, or any proboscidean actually has, they have a lot of dental plaque, especially on the last molars that are bigger. And they have a lot of information on the food that those individuals were actually eating. Because while the microware, we have only the scars that the food made on the molars, with the dental plaque, we can recover the original food, obviously fragments.
Wow.
or just pieces of fruits, leaves, and phytoliths that actually that individual ate.
Okay, so they had such bad teeth that you can go into their dental plaque and find direct evidence of what they were eating still trapped in their teeth.
Exactly. And since the molars are huge, they are very big, we can recover a lot of dental plaque.
I did not expect that.
It's a great technique. Actually, my postdoc is on paleoecology of Brazilian proboscideans, and I am using this technique to see what they eat.
And what kinds of environments did they live in? When I think of mastodons and I think of mammoths, I think of really cold and snowy places and these big hairy elephant things walking through it. Is that what these gomphotheres in South America were doing?
Well, in South America, these gomphotheres used to live everywhere. We have records on lowlands, like at the sea level. Include something. Some records are on beaches, because the sea level was lower in the past in some regions, and then we have proboscideans in localities that now are on the sea. Mm-hmm. If I can say that. And we have records on very high localities, such as in Andes, like Ecuador and Peru. So they just live everywhere.
And how cosmopolitan were they? Did they live everywhere around the world, or were they just confined to certain places?
Well, gomphotheres used to live everywhere in the world. This is considered the most cosmopolitan family, because we have records on Africa, Europe, Asia, North America, Central America, and South America. So most of the records of proboscideans around the world are from gomphotheres, regarding the region. But in South America, we only have two species. We can say that they were gomphotheres. There's a study on this, if they are really gomphotheres, but this is another subject. And in Central and North America, we have records of mammoths and mastodons, but we still don't know, or we need to investigate more, why the mammoths and mammoths or mastodons, they didn't reach South America, as other groups of gomphotheres, like other taxa, actually, like Stegomastodon or Hincotherium, they never reached South America.
So just two species in a whole continent, that's incredibly low diversity. But how disparate were they? How different were they from one another?
They are very different between each other. We have these two species, Nothomastodon platensis, that is known only for South America, and Cuvieronius iodum, that's known also to Central and North America. And all the taxonomic history of these proboscideans is very complicated, because in the beginning, almost every record was a different species. And then when I and other authors started to study the individual variation of these proboscideans, we found a huge range of variation, but with some features that are always present. So we use these features to identify those proboscideans. Nothomastodon, it has only one pair of tusks, the upper tusks, and they are never twisted. And the presence of enamel on the tusk, it's very variable. But we have other features, like on the skull, the shape of the skull, the shape of the mandible, that we can identify easily, Nothomastodon. Cuvieronius, it has two pairs of tusks, the upper tusk and the lower tusk on the mandible. The upper tusks, they are always, always twisted and with an enamel band, a lateral enamel band. And you can see this feature including on very fragmented specimens. So this is a good feature to use on the fossil record, because usually you find fragmented specimens, not a whole complete individual. And the lower tusks, it was very interesting to find this feature, because they are present only on very young individuals, like like babies, individuals with less than 1 or 2 years old.
So how common are each of these species? Do we find a lot more of one than we do the other?
Yeah, we found a lot more of Notiomastodon platensis than for Cuvieronius iodum. One of my last papers, we have a list of localities in South America with both proboscideans and localities that we still can't say the taxon, but for sure it's a record of proboscideans. And we have almost 200 localities of Notiomastodon and only 6 for Cuvieronius.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a huge difference. But one of these localities of Cuvieronius is the famous locality in Bolivia called Tarija. And this locality has a lot of individuals. I think like 30, 40 individuals, including babies, old individuals. And a lot of them are complete. So it's not quite relatable to the record of Notiomastodon, because we have a lot of localities with Notiomastodon, but we have only one locality among those 6 of Cuvieronius that the record is almost perfect, if you can say that for fossil record.
Yeah. And is there any overlap in the paleobiogeography? Were they living in the same places?
We don't have a record, like a locality, with both proboscideans in South America. They are very close, like in Ecuador and Peru. And now we just described the first record of Notiomastodon from Bolivia, including from the Tarija province. But they are a few kilometers far from each other, Cuvieronius and Notiomastodon. We believe that we infer that they had the same paleodiet habits, they quite often exclude each other because of competition for resources.
Okay, that's pretty interesting that they were very similar animals doing similar things in similar areas.
Yeah.
And so if we've got both of these things that are incredibly similar, just 2 different genera, why are you bothering to study them? What can we find out from just 2 different animals?
Well, hard question. When I started to study those proboscideans studied by Simpson and Paolo Couto in the 50s, I heard a lot this question, but why are you studying them? We know everything about them. Proboscideans are so common to find at the fossil record, so we know everything about them. And I start to see a lot of problems on taxonomy and lack of data on paleocology, and started to question myself a lot of things. And then the more I studied, the more I saw problems. And I think that there's a long research to do on these animals. Mm-hmm. For example, concerning the taxonomy of Notiomastodon, from along the studies started with Cuvier like 2 centuries ago, and almost every record was described as a new proboscidium from South America. Then we can say that the individual variations were not well studied, because it was not considered like individual variations but taxonomic features. And then in the last century, this proboscidean, the Notiomastodon, was considered as being a species of Stegomastodon. That's actually a proboscidian described to North America. And this proboscidian is absent from Central America. So it always draw my attention to this data. How it's present in South America and absent in Central America, and also the time is different because this proboscidian Stegomastodon is from the Pliocene, early Pleistocene of North America. Enotomastodon occurs only from middle Pleistocene to late Pleistocene in South America until the beginning of the Holocene. So I started studying these points and see that a lot of work is waiting to be done.
Are South American gomphotheres closer related to the North American proboscideans than they are to any of the others around the world?
Yeah. I found on the results of my thesis that actually the proboscideans in South America and in Americas, actually, like Stegomastodon, Notomastodon, Cuveronius, Rhynchotherium, we usually call them the Bunodont brevihostrian proboscideans. They are more closely related to each other, together with Cynomastodon, that it's a Bunodont brevihostrian proboscideans from Asia, that they are more closely related to each other than to other classic gomphotheres like Gomphotherium and the Amebelodontids. They were usually recovered in previous studies like a single clade, but I found these separated, if I can say that, in the hypothesis I found on my thesis. So I'm still working on some details of this phylogenetic hypothesis, but we can say that they are more closely related than to other gomphotheres.
And do we know about how the biotic exchange from North to South America has occurred?
Most of the records in South America of proboscideans, if not everything, it's from middle to late Pleistocene, or at least complete Pleistocene. Like, I think the oldest one is one from Argentina that has like 2.5 million years. So the main hypothesis, the general idea, is that the proboscideans arrived in South America during the Great American Biotic Interchange after the final uplift of the Panama Isthmus. And there's a lot of other groups like horses, big carnivores that also arrived at this time. But as nothing is that easy, we have a record of proboscidian in South America that we are recognizing as Miocene. It's from Peru. It was described like some decades ago as Amaocatherium. It's very famous actually because it's very controversial. And it's this record, this single record, could represent an early entrance of a proboscidian in South America. We have in Central America, we have records from middle Pleistocene, from late Pleistocene, like 10 million years. And why not one of those proboscideans could reach it, South America at that time? So we are working hard on this subject to see if the Great American Biotic Interchange was the beginning of the proboscideans history here in South America or if it was early.
So what happened to them? Why did they eventually go extinct?
Well, this is a great question. Actually, I think this is the question of my scientific life. if I can say that, because we have that some taxa such as Gomphotherium. Probably it got extinct on climatic changes, especially temperature. We have their complete extinction on the late Miocene, and where the Earth was experimenting a lot of climatic changes. But we have other proboscideans like Notomastodon and also Cuveronius in Central America and Mexico, they reached the early Holocene, or at least the very, very late Pleistocene, including living with early humans. And a great question is why they got extinct so close in time to us now. And the most common hypotheses relate the climatic changes and the human action. Like climatic change modify a lot of the environments, while the human action was working on the populations, if I can say, like hunting the young individuals or reducing the genetic potential of the populations to migrate. Or actually, there's a lot of hypotheses. There's a group that believe that human just hunt everything and kill it all proboscideans, but we had not only gomphotheres, we had also mammoths, mastodons, and a lot of other groups a part of proboscideans. And personally, I don't think that human could cause all the extinctions. I think a bigger driver probably did that to these groups.
I guess it's good to know that we didn't kill them all, potentially.
Yeah. It's very interesting because I hope that people that believe in overkill and really work with overkill don't want to kill me after that. But a few years ago, a few decades ago, the idea of overkill was very, very, very strong to explain all these mass extinctions. And I think in some places like Australia, it did happen. But a few studies, more recent studies like 10, 15 years ago to nowadays, they start to see the taphonomic evidence and paleoecological evidence of human interactions with megafauna, especially proboscideans. And actually, this is a research line I'm doing on the mammalogy lab and to South America. And to North America, there's a very interesting study that says that regarding all the Clovis culture sites before they were identified as killing sites, especially for proboscideans, they have only 14 sites or 15 sites with evidence of kill, like a tool very closely embedded in some part of the skeleton of the proboscidean, or this kind of evidence. Mm-hmm. And most of the sites are actually evidence of butchering, with cut marks and scavenging marks, not killing marks. And this is very interesting because we usually infer that if there is a human and a proboscidean together in a site, the human killed the proboscidean. And now I think we are changing our view on this. On this site or on this kind of evidences. And probably we will found different relations on these two.
Do you still think we have a lot to find out about gonfatheas, about how they lived and their interaction with early hominids?
Sure, absolutely. When we started studying the paleocology, the main idea, I think, is that the proboscideans were very, for example, restricted on diet. Like they ate very specific vegetation, and probably this vegetation went extinct or reduced the areas available. And we thought that, well, if they are very specific, like most mammoths were actually, this explained why they went extinct. And then we start finding that they could eat everything. They could eat everything. Like Nachomastodon basically ate everything available in the environment. We start asking, so why did they got extinct? Because it was not the food, probably was other or the cause. And I believe we need to start studying with different points of view the relation between human and proboscideans.
And finally, for you, do you feel that gonfatheas have a high enough profile throughout South America and abroad?
Yeah. Actually, the proboscideans in South America, together with other megafauna elements such as the giant armadillos and the giant sloths, they are one of the most common fossil that people are used to. For example, there's a lot of records that people start digging the yard, and they found like bones of a giant animal or just a giant, and they contact universities or labs or museums, and we go as the researchers and professors to rescue such specimens. And we start to do a work of like an explanation of what that record mean. Like 10,000 years ago, we had elephants, like not actually elephants, but we use the word elephant to explain easily to people that are not scientists to understand what is that huge animal there. And then I think proboscideans are easily to figure out like what they are. A lot of time people think that when they find a proboscidean bone, it's like a dinosaur bone because it's huge. And then we need to explain, no, you don't have a dinosaur. I'm sorry, this was just the South American elephant. And they start asking, oh my God, we didn't know that we had elephants here. And then we explain the whole thing on the Great American Biotic Interchange and the megafauna, Pleistocene, and everything.
And do you do a lot of outreach activities around this?
Yeah, I wish I could do more. And yeah, always. But we try to do this kind of work when we go to a place to do field work. We explain what we are doing there, that we are not robbing animals or minerals or something like this, that we retrieve fossils, and fossils, they don't have any economic value, just scientific value for studies at the university. And then we explain, like, we do lectures and we allow the kids of the city we go to do field work. to see the specimens and to join us in the day in a work. So I think this is very important, because if people don't understand what we do, how we expect them to respect or to value what we do as scientists and teachers and professors.
Are there any projects that you're running at the university yourself?
We make here at the Mammalogy Lab, we have a project on kids. That's very interesting, because we pick a day to explain the life of a paleontologist to kids. And I think it's great to see how they are interested. And of course, they are mostly interested in dinosaurs. And when we say, I'm sorry, we don't actually study dinosaurs. We study other stuff like giant sloths and horses and proboscideans. And they start asking like how they got extinct, how big they were. And it's interesting because the kids, they like the subject. But sometimes we don't see this subject as a regular one at the schools. Science should be more accessible to kids at the schools, like every day. You use science every day in your life, not only when you go to a museum or you see a movie like Jurassic Park or something.
When you speak to the kids in Brazil, do they see paleontology as a career that they can themselves get involved in?
I'm not sure if they see as a career, actually, like a doctor or something like this, like astronaut or something like this. But they sure have interest on the subject. So we explain that you can actually be a paleontologist and work on paleontologists if you go to the undergraduate on biology or geology, and then you got a postgraduate on geology or something like this. Because in Brazil, we don't have... now I think we start some programs on paleontology. But a few years ago, when I was studying, we don't have a specific post-graduation on paleontology, or we just have like sub-areas. And then we explain that, because sometimes paleontology in Brazil is treated like a hobby. We have a very, we struggle a lot with people that collect fossils and just keep them in their houses because they just don't know what to do, or they like the collection, but they don't know how to treat the specimens or take care of the specimens. I don't see the paleontology in South America, actually, and in Brazil too, as the first choice of the girls when they go to biology. Actually, it was not my first choice too. When I started studying biology, I knew that I want to study mammals, but I never thought about fossil mammals. And then when I started studying, I just get involved, and I used to say that I didn't choose paleontology, but the paleontology chose me. And then I start working with proboscideans, and this is such an amazing, amazing group, an amazing field to work. And there's a lot of difficulties, because when you go to alone to a travel to work, a lot of people start asking if you are sure, if you are able to work at the collections, and start to doubt on your capacity, I think. But this doesn't happen with men, with male paleontologists. And I think it's a field that we need to work a lot. Like, we can do whatever we want, and we can study anything we want.
Okay, well, Damila, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at @paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.